Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by Spiked columnist Anaya Follerin-Aman.
Hello.
And also by Spiked columnist Ella Whelan.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. This is a kind of an election special, a snap response to the snap poll. It's been a really remarkable one. I mean, it's a historic win for the Labour Party. They're looking at a huge majority, about 412 seats, just shy of the 1997 landslide, but still an incredible turnaround when thinking where they were just 5 years ago. The Tory party currently down 120 seats, which is their worst ever result by any metric. Absolutely incredible. We've also seen the Reform Party surge. We've seen sectarian voting. But let's start off, Anaya, with the Labour landslide, with the Labour victory. Obviously, on paper, it looks very good, but you start to dig into some of the numbers. There's remarkably low turnout. It looks like it's around 60%. Also, the vote share for Labour is 35%, which is significantly lower than even Jeremy Corbyn once got in 2017. What have you made of this slightly mixed picture where you've got a sizable majority for Labour, but clearly little public enthusiasm for it at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's clearly just been the collapse of the Tory vote. And even if you see at many of the Labour front benches, there isn't this sense of historic shift and excitement. Many of the electric feelings that we felt in 2019, because we recognised the significance of that particular vote, it's actually quite a muted atmosphere. And as you already alluded to, actually, if you dig down to some of these statistics, it paints a much more complicated picture. Keir Starmer got, as you mentioned, less share of the vote than Jeremy Corbyn in 2017. In terms of actual vote counts, similarly in 2019, their vote barely increased at all in England. One of the most significant shifts is in Scotland with the collapse of the SNP. And actually, their vote went down in Wales. So another interesting thing, I mean, Keir Starmer, I think he lost 10,000 votes, you know, several thousand votes in his own constituency. Reform are, very much on the tail of the Labour Party as much as it is the Conservative Party, because everyone always thinks, oh, well, they're just taking votes from the Conservatives. But they're a huge challenger in many of the northern seats against Labour as well. And then, as we will come onto it, many of the things in relation to the independent candidates, like Greens and other people like Jeremy Corbyn, shows a much more complicated picture than what the headline stonking majority actually shows.
And what do you think about that, Ella? Particularly, I suppose, the Labour piece of this. Do you think they are under any illusions as to how oddly thin their kind of support is in this election?
I actually think they don't care. Mm. And I listened to an interview with Pat McFadden, you know, top old Labour bod, very central to the Blair campaign, being interviewed this morning. And that was put to him that actually their vote share is comparable to Blair's post-Iraq vote share. You know, so like bad. You know, not good news, despite the fact that they have this big parliamentary majority. And he literally said, the thing that matters is the seats you win. And you know, he was pushed and said, well, hang on a minute, aren't you going to, you know, is it something to sort of think about, the fact that, you know, that there might not be a lot of popular support necessarily. And he just, it was the arrogance in his voice of just saying, oh, we don't care. And I think that was what also characterised Keir Starmer's sort of electoral campaign, which is that this is about winning the power, parliamentary power. It isn't necessarily about winning popular support. And obviously, we know that Starmer and Labour's managerial approach is not got a great amount of interest in, certainly not in populism, but in any kind of sense of grassroots surge. They know that they don't have that because their vote is split various ways. You know, people are on the left are annoyed with them in Gaza. People, others are annoyed with them about the women issue. There's the Greens part of their party annoyed with them. So it's complicated. But their response to that is to just say, so we won. And I thought that was really telling when I heard Pat McFadden say that this morning.
And of course, you know, first past the post, we know it has all these kind of dysfunctions. You play the system that you're dealt. It does seem like this strategy they've had of trying to really focus their energies on the seats where they need to win, rather than with Jeremy Corbyn, they were just piling up votes in places that they really didn't need them. But at the same time, you know, call me old fashioned, but getting elected shouldn't just be about, you know, gaming the system in such a way that produces the right amount of seats. It should be about getting a democratic endorsement for a particular program, which is clearly not existent in this particular moment.
If you listen to all the commentators this morning, there's everybody saying this, what a wonderful day for democracy. What a fantastic thing voting is. And everybody's being really boosterish about it. And in his sort of not resignation speech, he hasn't quite done that yet, but in his acceptance of failure speech, Rishi Sunak said something like, and I think what's really important to note is that we've had a peaceful transfer of power. You're like, well, hang on a minute. Is there some kind of like Tory rioters that I didn't know?
Maybe Alistair Campbell would have taken up arms if something had gone wrong. But actually,
if you're being sort of truthful, of course, we've had a free and fair election. But if you're being truthful about the state of democracy, you know, we've got this problem with the vote share. We've got this issue of the fact that, like as you and I said, this is more a sort of an election of disgust and of revulsion and of sacking off than it is getting in. And there's very little excitement even within the Labour camp on the kind of grassroots level. And, you know, not even acknowledging that that's kind of an issue and that the sort of the tone of the day is voter disillusionment rather than real excitement. And the fact that everybody's just glossing over that makes me really annoyed.
I mean, it is interesting. Like, I was listening to Ed Balls on ITV and you both may have seen it as well. I mean, we'll come on to the Conservatives, but it was interesting that he flat out admitted that Keir Starmer's strategy in order to gain power was to effectively dupe the grassroots into to vote for him by rehashing many of Jeremy Corbyn's left-wing talking points. And then,
so when he was going for leader, telling them one thing and then telling the country something very different.
Exactly. And then once he got the leadership, then effectively saying to the country what they wanted to hear. And, you know, some people are predicting, and I think, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for this because of all of this very shallow vote and the constraints that they have essentially put themselves in. And in some senses, misleading the public insofar as many people, I don't want to get into tax, but even just the fact that they wouldn't really tell people what was likely going to happen in terms of their economic policy, it may well unravel very, very quickly because it spread wide, but very shallow.
And it does remind me of New Labour in the sense that the election is almost like an obstacle to overcome. And then you set about doing the programme that you might not have told them about in the first place. A lot of the big New Labour reforms obviously weren't really in the manifesto or were kind of just vaguely hinted at. Similarly, some of the really significant cultural things, certainly that Keir Starmer wants to do, the Race Equality Act, even down to the plans that are in the offing for the union and devolution, really radical and quite damaging stuff in some respects. 16-year-olds, of course. Yeah. That's been a bit more upfront. But a lot of these other things haven't really received any scrutiny at all. And it does kind of seem like, you know, you get elected by any kind of cynical means necessary, and then you just set about imposing policies regardless of how popular they are. But while we're talking about things being unpopular, we should talk about the Conservatives, definitely. Inaya, what would you put their failure, and it is a historic failure, down to at this particular election? I mean, the more prosaic answer is the fact that not only has Rishi Sunak had a terrible go of it, but also we've seen reform really mount a really significant incursion into electoral politics, starting from more or less nowhere, and with Farage throwing his hat into the ring, getting to the point where they're on about 14% of the vote. They are going to get these four seats. They have been eating into Tory vote share, so allowing Labour to sneak through. But if you had to pin it on something broader, I guess, some sort of bigger failing on their part, what do you think has delivered this defeat for the Conservatives?
Well, I think it is, you know, similar to the 2019 situation, that realignment, as many people describe it, that was really trying to reinvigorate democracy, to transform our economic model to make sure that it works in the interest of a much broader range of people, i.e. levelling up. And that deeper transformative vision for society was never really met up to. And I think it is sad that some of the commentators that have come to the fore from the bigwigs in the Conservative Party already, as you would expect, they're saying, oh, this is because they, you know, have tacked too much to the right. And that, oh, actually, I think Sophie Ridge on Sky News even said that, it's, you know, they focus too much on the red wall. Mm-hmm. It is just fascinating, this analysis, that actually on many of the key things that won them the vote in 2019 were not delivered on. And regardless of what people's views on immigration, that was a very key aspect for a lot of voters. And that has been totally disregarded. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of that realignment, I still think that's a big issue because that's what Nigel Farage is now speaking to. Mm-hmm. So clearly that tapping into that is still necessary for them to succeed. And I don't buy into this idea that there can't be a coalition between the red walls and the so-called blue wall. Actually, a vision that speaks to the concerns and interests of a broad range of people in society, I think actually can win a much larger group of people.
I think it has to be the B word, Brexit, because, you know, we did a lot of work at Spiked trying to explain, even to some quite hardline Brexiters, the folly in treating Brexit as a policy issue to just be sort of completed and shelved and like have the tick in the box of Brexit, that actually this, you know, and we were much mocked for talking about the spirit of Brexit, but, you know, genuinely this sense that for the first time in, you know, generations, you have people who haven't ever voted and have no interest in parliamentary politics coming out en masse to make their voices heard and the destruction of that and blah, blah, blah. We know the story. That you know, there was just the glimmer in 2019 of that being rekindled or taken seriously, that even though the sort of Brexit policy issue was done by Boris in some, you know, in sort of a way, but that sense of things needing to change and, yeah, a realignment, but also a sort of democratic spirit was just over a long period of time throughout the COVID years chipped away at, squandered. And so I've been really frustrated at, as much as I'm glad she got kicked out, Liz Truss, I've been really frustrated at hearing Conservative MPs and commentators saying, well, what did we expect when we had the Liz Truss event? This is why we're paying for the Truss event. And you're like, that's so short-sighted.
It's one in a long line of reasons.
Well, exactly. You know,
incredibly.
Actually, one commentator said something about the Charles era of you know, of the King Charles, the era. And he said, and Keir Starmer will be the third prime minister. And I was like, hang on a minute. And then realised it was right. But
sometimes forget Liz Truss was prime minister. Well, like, yeah, I could go days without, you know, remembering that.
That and a lettuce or whatever the joke was. But I don't think there has been one event, or even that it was that Rishi Sunak was crap. All those things are true. It's just this long process of people having a moment in 2016, 2017, where you think something could happen here, and that just dissipating.
Yeah.
And I think the low turnout, the fact that there hasn't been this massive shift from Tory to Labour, all of that speaks to people just retreating. And that is a bad thing for those of us who are interested in politics. But I'm not going to blame those people for staying at home, because I felt the same.
And where they're not retreating, where that Brexit coalition is asserting itself, is via the reform vote. That is the sort of Brexit spirit coming back to haunt the Conservatives, if I'm not labouring the metaphor too much. But that was really striking. I mean, if you look at the four seats that they won, I mean, certainly Clacton, I mean, it was about a 70% leave vote. It's also a place with a lot of economic problems. It's got the most impoverished community in the country. Jaywick is in Clacton, in that constituency, where Richard Tice has won Boston Skegness, kind of very similar profile, very high leave vote, but also a lot of economic issues, a sort of reminder that those voters haven't given up, not just on the Brexit question in eye, but also that sense that they should have a seat at the table. I mean, do you think reform have got an opportunity now to really capitalise on this? Because on top of those four seats, they've obviously got a significant vote share, but also they came second in almost 100 seats. So it's a significant marker that they put down here.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, interestingly, I do think Nigel is shifting on this, Nigel Farage. I mean, he has, even though he, for the last few years, he has been known as almost a, you know, a Thatcherite, essentially, that is, you know, an economic libertarian, and that's... There was the Singapore on Thames narrative that people like Richard Tice forwarded during Brexit. But actually listening to him, interestingly, over the last few weeks in this campaign, he has been talking differently. And even if people disagree on the specific policies, for example, you know, when it came to the two-child benefit cap, his argument was that actually we do need to support families. He talked about helping people to, you know, have more children, all of the, and I listened to him on a podcast recently, and he talked about, you know, the atomization of liberalism. So I'm wondering who's kind of, you know, speaking to Nigel Farage in his ear, but it's interesting that he's clearly seeing that, that the voters that he needs, to tap into, in this election are speaking to something much deeper, and much more transformative. And Nigel has obviously represented that, that the Brexit vote in many ways for a lot of people for a number of years. But I think reform will need to have that philosophical depth and tap into that real sense if they are going to turn this into something even more powerful for 2019, which is, I think, already what they're talking about, 2029.
And I think also if you just reflect on, in some ways, how disastrous reform's electoral campaign was in terms of embarrassments around vetting, maybe in some ways understandable, but also unacceptable organization of a kind of political party and the shallowness of a lot of the policies. The fact that they still have been so successful, maybe you're put down to desperation and voters needing to have some kind of outlet when they're frustrated at everyone else. But I think it's more the fact that there is, you know, they do speak to that Brexit spirit, but also a bit like what you were saying, Anaya, in some of the debates, Farage has been capitalising on what would have traditionally been a Labour's sort of ground of saying, well, of course, we need loads more doctors. Mm. And you know, things very normal, sensible things like, well, no, I don't just want to do a sort of, no, I don't just want private healthcare and to sack off the NHS. I want to reform it and all the rest of it. And he hasn't become the sort of the far right goblin that the others have tried to paint him as. Mm. He's in every single debate, he has won by a country mile. He comes across as normal, sensible, honest. Richard Tice, I'm not so much of a fan of, and Lee Anderson, that's the less said about him, the better. But I think that there's this, you know, people don't want the more of the same in terms of the Conservatives or the Labour Party. I mean, Labour's whole identity is more of the same from the Labour standpoint. It's just let's continue the sort of Blair years in this very strong and steady and stagnant way. I think there's, you know, I don't want to necessarily say there's some kind of authentic working class pushback in reform, but certainly in places like Jaywick or like that, that is, you, I don't know how you could describe it otherwise. And it's the only thing that's keeping me going in this rather dull and expected election night is that those kind of glimmers of hope for the future of this being quite a weird parliament, if you think about it. You've got to, you know, reform. Okay, the Greens, not so excited about them. Independents, not so excited by them. But this kind of, there's a real mishmash, actually, despite the Labour majority. And I think that can, and some real personalities in there. And I think that can produce some kind of space for a bit of interesting political debate happening in the next months and years. And thank God for that, because you can't do more of the same.
And exactly. It's like, even despite the result being as large as it is for Labour and so on, you still see that bristling with the party duopoly on both sides, sometimes for more positive reasons than others, which we should get onto now, actually, because one of the interesting... some of the interesting upsets for Labour over the course of the past 24 hours have been where even some of their leading politicians were turfed out. Sometimes it would be because of essentially pro-Gaza independent candidates. In other situations, it was Greens, but who were also very much running on the Gaza question. But I just stick with the those independents who are basically challenging Labour on the Israel question, but also very much trying to play into, in many cases, a kind of sense of Muslim identity politics, very much targeting that community. It's been interesting to see how poorly Labour have done in constituencies where there is a sizable Muslim population. Is this something that is depressingly looking like it's going to become a feature of British politics, this very kind of sectarian, sectional approach to trying to get yourself elected?
Yeah, and obviously at Spite, you know, we've been talking about this for years, but there was a couple articles in the media on it, but there wasn't really that much scrutiny. And many of us have been talking that for years, if you constantly encourage religious, racial and cultural minorities to see themselves through the lens of said identity, but also say that the fundamental prism for which they should engage in politics is through grievance, then that inevitably is going to have a consequence. And actually, I was, before even this election, looking at some of the videos of some of the candidates, and many of their videos were all Muslim individuals in Islamic dress. Oftentimes they were speaking a different language, and it was all about religion a lot of the time. It was like, this is, you know, you're doing this for God, you're doing this for all of these different things that was clearly not trying to speak to a broader British audience. And you know, everyone is entitled to organize politically for concerns that they care about, but it's the way in which it's done through this identitarian lens, which has very much been encouraged by the our institutions. And the tragedy of it as well is that I feel a lot of Muslim voters are being let down. When it came to the issue of the Israel-Palestine conflict, really in the election, the Labour Party have chosen to avoid it and really created a vacuum for all of these other individuals to have these very absolutist views. They could have made a passionate case about actually, you know, why, if they wanted to support Israel, they should do that. And this is the best way to get peace in this particular scenario. But rather than do that, they either cowered, or we saw Angela Rayner going to a mosque and exaggerating the things that she was doing for the Muslim community in order to appeal to them in a very religious lens. And I think this is letting Muslim people down as much as the rest of us.
Also, the dishonesty with which Labour has addressed the sort of Islamist problem means that they deserve what they've got in those constituencies. Jess Phillips in Birmingham and Yardley got her majority quite severely knocked, but still came out on top. And just quite remarkable scenes during her acceptance speech. She was shouted down in a really quite grotesque manner, constantly shouted down. And by by men, she said, and the way in which she talked about it on Twitter afterwards was, men were shouting me down. It wasn't just men. It wasn't just like your average guy in Birmingham Yardley. It was a group of men from that particular constituency who were pushing for the Gaza vote, who, you know, as she even said from the floor, oh, you don't like a woman, you know, standing up for herself. And the fact that she can't identify, there's a cowardice about identifying exactly why those particular men from that particular section of society don't like women being forthright, just means that the issue will never be addressed. And I think that kind of cowardice has really bitten them. I mean, I spoke to a cab driver about a week ago about who was from Bangladesh, about which way they were voting in Bowen Stratford. Roshanara Ali also had her majority quite severely challenged by the independent there. And he was just quite upfront and said, well, it's a vote for Palestine, but also we don't like what they've said about what Keir Starmer said about the Bangladeshis and asylum seeking and all that kind of controversy that happened. But there was, you know, you had people standing outside Roshanara Ali's kind of campaign trail with kids shouting in megaphones, shame on you, shame on you. And at no point did any Labour MP turn around and say, hang on a minute, and have a row. Mm. They just pretend it's not happening. Yeah. And so they deserve it.
And as you said, and I completely agree, they have actively, you know, promoted this idea of a Muslim community leader, yep. That is often, you know, very socially conservative, and elevated them to very high status when it comes to various different social and political conversations about Islam, immigration, integration, all of these kinds of things. And this is really just the logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, we and I just think that Labour, it is clear, will still not confront this issue. If anything, you know, he has promised to supercharge the whole Islamophobia definition into law and other things, which is essentially going to chill discussion on many issues around this area. So mm-hmm. it's likely going to accelerate.
The only upset to this trend, of course, is George Galloway, who yes. I am delighted only had 54 days in Parliament.
That was a very nice one to see him packing amongst a load of Portillo moments, if you can count it as that. But it does feel depressingly like Galloway-style politics is very much baked in, not least because the Labour Party has spent so long practising it, appealing to voters, as you suggest, on the basis of their cultural or religious identity. And even the Tories have been caught out with that a number of times in recent years. Even in this campaign, you had Mario Longhi, who was caught drawing attention to the fact that his Labour challenger had a Hindu Indian name. All caps. You know, you can tell what sort of games are being played there. But while we're talking about Galloway and Scotsman losing their seats, we should finish by talking quickly about the SNP. As you were saying, Anaya, Scotland was the one area where we really saw a surge for Labour, something like 17 points. And that has been almost completely at the expense of the SNP, which has been hegemonic in Scotland for so long, but has really suffered a complete collapse there. We haven't got much time to talk about this. And obviously, it's a bit depressing that this had to come at the cost of Labour seats. But what are both your take on it, Anaya?
Yeah, I mean, that's one positive thing that, you know, we can see. I mean, the record of the SNP, even within the devolved Scottish Parliament, really speaks for itself. Pretty much every metric has been a disaster for them politically. But also, they're not really even a believer in independence. You know, they don't actually believe in sovereignty. They despise Brexit venomously. They're quite happy to cede sovereignty to a much less accountable body like the European Union. And much of their politics was just based off of quite infantile, mm-hmm. anti-Tory, you know, anti-Brexit rhetoric. In a way that it's good that the SNP are being decimated by the Labour Party, but the tragedy is that much of Labour's success is mm-hmm. actually based off of their victory in Scotland, when in Wales and England it's not been the same.
It is complicated, isn't it? Because I was listening to Joanna Cherry this morning being asked why this had happened, and she wouldn't touch the gender issue. I mean, this is Joanna Cherry,
yeah.
And she wouldn't mention it. And, you know, I was thinking, well, surely that was a big deal. But then, you know, the Labour Party's views in relation to women and the trans issue certainly not a million miles away from the SNP. The SNP was a particular kind of nuts, and the Labour Party is sort of a milder strain of that. So I think it is perhaps complicated. I mean, the fact is the SNP haven't barely even mentioned the word independence in the last, definitely the last year, the last few years. It's all been these very vicious attacks, specifically on free speech, specifically on Scottish People's Agency. And so you hope that there's been some kind of Scottish freedom pushback against some of the madder stuff, whether it's being listened to by devices in your home or, you know, bans on all kinds of political speech. But the fact that it, I think maybe it's that the Tories are just so useless. Maybe it's that there was nowhere else to go. But it's one to watch in Scotland because the Labour majority there doesn't spell an end or an even a change to the kind of identity politics driven nature of the Scottish political landscape.